bent double, I battled along the boardwalk, the wind screaming in my ears and tearing at my clothes. Through the slit of the doghouse doorway, my torchlight revealed snowy mounds that erupted as I flung in the meat. The dogs seemed unfazed by the storm and delighted at their early meal. Fuel, I thought as I struggled back. Logs and a drum of paraffin. It took hours to drag it all into the hall. Then I had to clear away the snow that had found its way in, too. It's nearly midnight, and still the blizzard is battering the cabin. It's flinging snow at the windows like pebbles and moaning in the stovepipe. It's making every plank creak and groan. God, I hope the roof stays on. Hope the windows hold. The shutters are in the emergency store at the other end of the bay. Might as well be in Timbuktu. But in a strange way, I welcome the storm. It's a known physical force. A rush of snow-laden air generated by pressure differentials. These are things I can understand. And it's better than the stillness. 6th of November. 3 days, and no let-up. The storm never stops for an instant. The din is indescribable. A booming, like a train. A wailing in the stovepipe. I'm finding it rather tiring. Even when I'm asleep, I dream of trams rattling and screeching. I can't remember what silence is like. I can understand why the Vikings believed in storm giants. I keep having to remind myself that there is no intention behind this. It feels so angry, as if it wants to tear apart the cabin and carry me off into the night. Reaching the Stevenson screen is out of the question. But I've kept up my contact with Olsen on Bear Island, thank God the wireless masts have held firm. In my transmissions I affect a seasoned old campaigner calm. It's a big one, stop, snow up to my windows, stop, time to catch up on my reading. I exchange messages with Algy and through him with Gus. Bit of a blow, stop, screen must take its chances, stop, at least it's keeping the bay free of ice, stop, dogs fine, stop, I think they like it. Algy's replies are jaunty and boy scoutish. Jolly good show, Jack. We know it takes more than a bit of a breeze to shake your nerve. You're right about that, Algy, old chap. Unlike you, I'm not one to get in a blue funk because of a few bad dreams, but then you know that already, don't you, old man? Clinging to my routine, I take my walks inside the cabin, making careful circuits about the main room and berating myself if I lose count and have to start all over again, which I often do. I try once a day to take food to the dogs, but in reality it's more like every other day, so when I do, I give them lots to make up for it. Each time I have to chop away the wind-packed snow blocking their doorway. They seem all right, if a bit cowed. But I worry. What if they suffocate? What if I can't get to them and they eat each other? When I'm in the cabin, I talk to them through the bunkroom wall, or rather I shout, and they yowl back. At least then I know they're still alive. To think there was a time when I actually liked snow. It's horrible. Stinging your eyes. Blinding you, leading you astray. Each time I open the door, I let in a whirlwind and have to spend ages clearing it up, although I admit that this helps keep the water barrel full. And still the snow finds its way in, sifting under doors and through hidden cracks I never knew existed. Frost is beginning to crust the inside walls of the cabin and gather under the bunks. You wouldn't think it could get as far as the main room, but it does. I spend hours scraping it off, mopping up damp, drying towels over the stove. That stove. Before, it was merely temperamental. Now it's diabolical. although I can still get it to light if I splash the logs with paraffin, but three times, a particularly savage gust of wind has blown a great cloud of smoke down the stovepipe and out into the cabin, which leaves me black as a chimney sweep, coughing up my lungs with hours of cleaning ahead. That's the storm's vicious little joke, ha ha ha. Despite my efforts, the walls are now grimy with soot. It's got into the wood. I can't scrub it clean. To cheer myself up, I flouted my ration plan this evening and put out Christmas bottles of champagne to cool in the porch. To cool? Jack, have you gone daft? Both bottles froze within minutes and burst with a sound like a rifle report. I picked out the broken glass and salvaged what I could, a large bowl of frozen mush. I've been eating it with a spoon. It's delicious. Bit strong, though. Whoops. Jack, you're drunk. Or tipsy, as Gus would say. Off to bed with you. 8th of November. 6 days, and still blowing. 4 days to go till Gus and Algy get back, although that's only my guess. And Algy did say at least 2 weeks. And if the storm keeps up, they wouldn't even set out. That champagne was too much for me. I went down like a stunned ox. Bit of a sick headache this morning, but Algy's effervescing morning powder put me to rights. You're prevaricating, Jack. Out with it. As soon as I got up, I went to the north window and peered into the swirling grey. The bear post was back. Feverishly, I rubbed my breath off the glass. There it was, straight. Tall. Not possible. You chopped it down. You hacked it to pieces with an axe. The storm must have thrown up another log from the shore. But then, why does it stand so upright and still? And isn't it closer than before? And a little to the right? Nearer the porch? A gust of extraordinary violence struck the window and I drew back. And when I looked again, the post was gone. All I saw was snow, twisting in columns in the screaming wind. There was no post. There never was a post. That was 5 hours ago. Since then, I've managed to get a sack of seal meat to the dogs. I've told Bear Island that I'm fine. I've eaten a tin of boiled mutton and another of pears, and I've smoked a whole packet of Players. I've also flicked through this journal, which was a mistake. I'm shocked at how my handwriting's changed. I used to write a neat copperplate hand. Since I've been alone, it's degenerated into a spidery scrawl. Without reading a word, you can see the fear. When the storm blew up, I wrote that I welcomed it. All that about pressure differentials and things I can understand. Bollocks. The constant din, the screaming fury. It's wearing me down. Grinding away my defences. 9th of November. I woke to silence. Unbroken, unbelievable silence. Not a whisper of wind disturbing the peace. The blanket over the bunkroom window had come down and I was lying in moonlight. The window panes were silver squares crisscrossed with black. Putting out my hand, I felt the light seeping into my skin. I was an underwater swimmer, floating in light. Beautiful, beautiful light. I was so grateful I wanted to cry. At last, disentangling myself from my sleeping bag, I pulled on my clothes and padded to the window. There before me hung the full moon. Huge, shining, golden. Every detail of camp lay sparklingly revealed. Where the bear post had been, I saw only a gentle curve of snow. Like a recovering invalid, I shuffled about the cabin, tearing down blankets to let in the moon. I got the stove going. I didn't light any lamps. I didn't want anything to diminish that miraculous light. Soon I would go out and tend to the dogs and see if the Stevenson screen was still there, but not yet. The moon drew me. I wanted to gaze and gaze. I hated to waste a moment. At the north window, I cupped my hands to a pane and peered out. The storm had cleared the ice from the bay. The moon cast a path of beaten silver over the sea, leading away from Gruhooken. Beautiful, I murmured. Beautiful. I watched it rise higher. I watched it gradually change from gold to silver, losing none of its brilliance. My breath misted the pane. I cleared it with my sleeve. When I looked again, a thin haze of cloud had dimmed the moon to inky blue. That moment, I sensed I was not alone. With my nose pressed to the window, I felt horribly vulnerable. But I couldn't pull away. I had to look. Where the bear post had been, a figure was standing. Around it, the snow glimmered faintly, but no light touched what faced me. It cast no shadow. It stood utterly still, watching me. In one appalling heartbeat, I took in its wet, round head and its arms hanging at its sides, one shoulder higher than the other. I felt its will coming at me in waves, intense, unwavering, malign, such malevolence. No mercy, no humanity. It belonged to the dark beyond humanity. It was rage without end, a black tide drowning. And still I pressed my hands against the pane. I couldn't pull away. A dreadful communion. I don't know how long I stood there. At last I had to breathe, and the pain misted over. When I'd cleared it, the figure was gone. I ran to the west window and peered out. Nothing. The radio masts mocked my terror. I ran to the bunkroom window. Again, nothing. I ran back into the main room and halted to listen. All I heard was the painful thudding of my heart. The clouds had cleared. And once again the moon shone bright. The snow in front of the cabin was smooth. Innocent. Nothing to show that something had stood there. But it had. It had. I had felt its will. Its malevolence beating at me. At me. I've been wrong. 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 This is no echo. Chapter 13. 9th of November. Later. I stood 3 feet from the window, staring at my reflection in the pane. If only I could believe that what I'd seen had been myself. But when you see yourself in a dark window, you see yourself, your own face and build. What I'd seen had had no unkempt beard, no wild hair sticking up all over its head. It had no face. What is it? What does it want? Why is it angry with me? Is it because I destroyed the hut? What can I do to appease it? Behind me, a crackle of static. The lights of the Eddystone flickered to life. I must have switched it on as I hurried about taking down blankets from the windows, although I didn't remember. And yet there it was, a transmission. My knees buckled. A transmission! Was that what I'd just experienced? Something forcing its way through, like blood staining a bandage? From the doghouse came urgent yowls. The storm's over. We're hungry. In a cracked voice, I called to them that I was coming soon. Once again, tatters of inky cloud were drifting towards the moon like a hand reaching to cover it. Without taking my eyes from that bright, bruised face, I put on the headphones and grabbed my notepad. I had to keep watching the moon. If I didn't, clouds would hide it again, and then... Gus here. Stop. Gus? Against doctor's orders, he'd made Algy take him to the wireless station. My hand shook as I tapped an inadequate reply. How are you? Sore, bored, cross. How are you? Fine. Stop. Really? My finger paused on the key. Yes, really, I replied. Bad dreams, but better. Now, stop. The answer came in a swift staccato rattle. Jack, are you all right? Mr. E is here, can fetch you in 2 days. Stop. No, am fine. Storm long, but fine now. Stop. Why did I say that? Why not? Yes, come quick, I can't bear it. Because it was Gus at the other end. Gus, the golden-haired prefect whom Jack, the eager schoolboy, is so desperate to impress. Jack, you're amazing. I'm so terribly grateful. Expedition scuppered without you. I flushed with pleasure. Gus knew what I was braving to be here on my own. He knew what he owed me. I basked in his gratitude and admiration. Now he was asking about the dogs. Dogs splendid, I replied. Am ve glad have them. Specially Isak ripping hound. Stop. As I tapped out my message, my eyes began to sting. It was so wonderful talking to Gus. But it hurt. Made me miss him even more. Jack, you muff. I knew you liked them. Stop. Yes, stop. Idiot, stop. Yes, stop. I sat there grinning through my tears. Felt so good to have him tease me. So normal and warm and human. On and on we talked. Inconsequential chat, but everything to me. At last he said he had to go. I couldn't think of anything to delay him, so we agreed when next to speak and said our goodbyes. I switched off the receiver and stared at my printed notes of his words. Talking to him had changed everything. It made me even more sharply aware of my isolation, but it also gave me strength. I was no longer the frightened obsessive who'd cowered in the storm and fought an illusory battle with a log. I was Jack Miller, the man who's keeping the 1937 Spitsbergen expedition alive against all the odds. I sat straighter. I took satisfaction in the cabin's every mundane detail. The orderly tins of powdered egg and breakfast cocoa on the kitchen shelves, the clean steel lines of the bicycle generator. I felt the roughness of the table beneath my palms. I sniffed the familiar smells of paraffin, wood smoke and unwashed clothes. This is my world. Modern. Practical. Real. Realizing I was ravenous, I tore open a bar of chocolate and wolfed it down. The sweetness burned my mouth. The rush of energy made me giddy. I brewed coffee and gulped 2 scalding mugs. I made a vast bowl of scrambled eggs with sausages and cheese. I lit lamps and tuned the wireless to the BBC. I reveled in each prosaic task. Just now I went to the bunkroom window. The sea is black and dotted with icebergs, but they're few and far between. I was right, the storm has kept the bay open. The dogs have dug their way out of the doghouse and are bounding about in the snow. Near the cabin, the drifts are almost to the window, but a few yards off it's shallower, and their paws don't sink in too far. When they saw me, they lashed their tails and yowled at me to come out. They wouldn't do that if there was anything there. Animals sense these things, don't they? But it will be back. I know this. I carry that knowledge inside me, like a stone. What does it want? What terrible thing happened here to make it haunt with such malevolence? I think of all the savagery I've ever heard about. I remember Algy's love of killing, his indifference to that seal's agony. his willingness to mutilate the dogs. What happened here? Later. Can't believe I was so stupid. When I was talking to Gus, I was so overwhelmed that I forgot to ask the all-important question, when are you coming back? And why didn't he say anything of his own accord? The 12th of November. By my calculation, that's the soonest they'll arrive. It's 3 days away, but surely, if they'd been about to set off, Gus would have said something. What isn't he telling me? How much longer have I got to hold on? I have to go out again. The sky is clear. There's no cloud to cover the moon. 10th of November. Yesterday feels like a million years ago. I remember nerving myself with a shot of whiskey and a cigarette to go outside, then opening the door to a wall of snow. God, I was relieved. Here was a physical task I could cope with. The dogs heard me digging and set up an impatient clamour. I hacked my way through and they fell on me, lots of eager muzzles and flailing paws. When at last I could look about me, I found Gruhuken transformed. The moon shone almost as bright as day. The snow was dazzling. Around me the camp lay radiant and serene. Serene. I felt not a trace of dread. No taint of that malign presence. The moon had banished it. Buckling on my snowshoes, I made my way down to the shore, the dogs bounding along, vying for my attention. Moonlight turned the mountains to pewter. In the bay, icebergs glowed. At the water's edge, little black waves rimmed with grey foam lapped the shore. I breathed in great lungfuls of clean, freezing air. I felt the light soaking into my consciousness, dispelling the shadows from the deepest recesses of my brain. Whatever had come in the dark couldn't harm me in the light. I worked for hours. First, I fetched tin after tin of pemmican for the dogs. Then I cleared the boardwalk and shoveled a path round the back of the cabin, another to the emergency store, and another to the Stevenson screen, which by some miracle has survived intact. As I worked, it occurred to me that somewhere beneath me lay the remains of the bear post. It belonged to another time. It had lost its power to terrify. The luxury of working in light. And the moon stayed with me all the time. Gruhuken is so far north that when the moon is full, it doesn't set, but circles endlessly in the sky, so that you never lose sight of it. It's a miracle. A gift from the gods. Whenever you look up, there it is, watching over you. Having finished my paths, I cleared the Stevenson screen and the other instruments, and collected my first set of data since the storm. I transmitted them to Bear Island. I got the Austin going and sent a report to England. I'd skipped that during the storm. Then I went and stood in front of the porch and smoked a cigarette, like a settler in the old American West, surveying his homestead. I had regained possession of my camp, Jack Miller's. The dogs had been playing on the shore, but suddenly Oopik skittered to a halt and pricked her ears. One by one the others did the same. Had they caught the scent of a bear? I was about to fetch my gun when Svartan gave a low bark and hurtled west. The rest of the pack raced after him. As the patter of paws receded, I heard what they had heard. A scraping sound, echoing in the stillness. Scrape. 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 Regular. Long drawn out. But this was utterly different from the sound I'd heard at the bear post. This sound belonged to my world. The dogs came rushing back, their eyes bright with excitement. Behind them, grey against the snow, I made out the figure of a man. My heart leapt. That's a cliché, but it really did leap as I watched him approach, his arms and legs moving in a slow, sure rhythm, as he skied. Waving and shouting inanely, I ran to meet him. "Hello there! Over here!" A stocky figure in a sheepskin coat. He wore huge fur mittens, canvas boots, a shapeless fur cap. Beneath it I saw a frost-crusted beard and a walrus moustache, bristling brows and small, bright eyes. I was grinning like a madman, but I couldn't stop. "Trapper Bjorvik, I presume. Welcome. You are most, most welcome." My visitor leaned on his ski poles in a haze of frosty breath. "Yah," he said, drawing off one mitten and taking my hand in a crushing grip. "Bjorvik." Later. I made a complete fool of myself. I gushed, I babbled, I poured. He was good enough not to mind, or at least not to show it. With the unpretentious formality that's so endearing in Scandinavians, he presented me with his visiting gift, a sack of reindeer hearts, ptarmigan livers, and other choice cuts which, with his rucksack, sleeping bag and rifle, he'd carried on his back the 20 miles from his cabin. He didn't say why he'd come, or how long he meant to stay, and I didn't ask. Ericsson once told me that in Spitsbergen, you tend not to ask, you simply assume that your guest will stay at least a week, and that his purpose is simply to visit. "I know I'm talking too much," I blurted out as we took off our things in the porch, "but I've been alone for nearly 3 weeks." I flushed. It occurred to me that Bjorvik must have been on his own for months. "Yeah," he grunted, pulling off his boots. "Is good to visit?" His boots were trapper's boots, a double thickness of canvas with a rubber sole worn over two pairs of socks and stuffed with straw. He wore the blue drill overalls of a sealer, with a heavy sweater of undyed wool that smelt powerfully of sheep. Belatedly, I realized he was poor. As flustered as a young hostess giving her first dinner, I sat him down, then bustled about lighting lamps, getting the stove going, making coffee. He planted his red hands on his knees and stared about him. I found music on the wireless. I put together an enormous meal. Tin stewed veal and spinach, eggs, bacon, cheese, oat cakes, tinned cherries with condensed milk, peanut brittle, and everything else I could think of. To hell with my ration plan. This man had skied 20 miles to see me. We ate in bashful silence. At least I was abashed, as my conversational sallies had met with monosyllables. But Bjorvik told me later that he was simply absorbed in listening to Ivan Novello on the wireless. He doesn't own a radio, and it's been 2 years since he heard music. After we'd eaten, I offered whiskey and tobacco. Declining the whiskey with grave dignity, he filled his pipe. By this time I'd stopped worrying about the monosyllables. I've never enjoyed a smoke as much as I did then. Ivan Novello gave way to the news program, and I lowered the volume. "Is good," said Bjorvik, with his slow nod. Resisting the temptation to nod back, lest he mistake it for mimicry, I agreed that it was good, very good, although I didn't know if he meant the food, music, tobacco, or me. I said, "You know, in England, I used to prefer being on my own. Now I think the best thing in life is having a visitor." Beneath his brows, his eyes glinted. Slapping his knee, he barked a laugh. "Yeah, it's good." I'm writing this in my bunk. Bjorvik is in Algie's, the bottom one nearest the window. He's snoring softly. A wondrous sound. I'm not alone anymore. To see the cabin windows aglow when I come in. To feel the warmth of a well-stoked stove. And when I'm inside to hear his tread on the boardwalk, his whistling as he chops wood and fetches ice from the stream. Yesterday feels like a million years ago. Yeah, it's good. 12th of November. 2 days have flown by. Yesterday I had a transmission from Algie. He said all's fine, but it'll be a few days before they set off. I can cope with that now because I'm not alone. No one could have a better, kinder, easier house guest, In many ways he reminds me of Erickson, the same rugged face, which at times undergoes a seismic shift as an earthquake of laughter rumbles to the surface, the same half-humorous, half-admiring respect for young English gentlemen, with their passion for the weather, the same avuncular protectiveness, as if I were a talented but ignorant nephew, who must be watched lest he blunder into trouble. I call him Mr. Bjorvik, and he calls me Mr. Jack. In deference to his ways, we eat our main meal at 2. After that we play cards or listen to the wireless, but never at the same time, as he thinks that's disrespectful to the BBC. At 8 we eat a simple supper of eggs and bacon, and at 9:30 he bids me good night and turns in while I sit up, relishing the security. He's used to plain food, mostly seal and reindeer. He calls it all beef. Flour bannocks, blubber, dried apricots and gallons of coffee. He delights me to treat him to tinned mutton and pork, Australian fruit salad, tinned vegetables, digestive biscuits and chocolate. Yesterday he shot a reindeer. He calmly ignores their protected status, and we had huge succulent steaks and blood pancakes, which are delicious. You don't taste the blood. We also ate the slippery marrow from the hind legs, which was delicious too, but had me making frequent trips to the outhouse, much to Bjorvik's amusement. My favourite time is after supper. I read and smoke, and he smokes and carves, a pair of clogs for the cold weather to come, an antler sheath for his knife. He's devouring Algy's crime novels, and is particularly fond of Edgar Wallace. Several times an hour I go to the window and check the sky for clouds. I know it's silly, but I can't help myself. I resent the least haze obscuring the moon. And it happens so suddenly. One moment you're looking at that bright, pure disk. The next it's gone, swallowed by inky darkness. I thought Bjorvik would laugh at my anxiety, but he doesn't even smile. I get the sense that he understands exactly why I need the light. I haven't mentioned the haunting, and he hasn't spoken of it, but I'm sure he knows. He tells me he's been hunting on this part of the coast for years. He knows. Once, when I asked if he's ever experienced rar, he gave me a wary look and said he's never had any trouble on his stretch of the coast. And this evening, when I said I prefer this wind we're having to the dead stillness, he said, "Yeah, the stillness, when you hear yourself blink, is terrible." Later he asked about the bear post, and when I told him I'd cut it down, he frowned. That was my chance. I should have said something. Why didn't I? Because I don't want to. Because I'm afraid that if I talk of it, I might somehow invoke it. Back in August at first dark, Erickson asked if I'd spoken to it. I understand now why he thought that was important. For the same reason I don't want to mention it to Bjorvik, because I feel that if I did, I'd be inviting it in. Besides, with any luck, I won't need to. If all goes well and the sea stays clear, Gus and Algy will be back before Bjorvik leaves. 14th of November. A storm blew up after I wrote that, a north wind from the pole. It's over now. But this morning the sky was so overcast that I couldn't see the moon. And the bay was full of ice. I was horrified. The sea was gone. In its place were huge chaotic slabs and tilting pinnacles like some fantastic frozen city. I couldn't believe it. The pack ice isn't supposed to arrive until after New Year. When I said so to Bjorvik, he barked a laugh. "Nay, nay, Mr. Jack. This is not pack ice. Let come in January and you will know it. You will see the islyning. The ice blink when it throw the light in the sky. This is just drift ice from the storm. Very dangerous. You stay off it, Mr. Jack. But don't worry, soon the wind change, And the ice, sir, it clear. He was right, of course. The wind has changed, and already it's blowing the ice out to sea. I wish I knew as much as Bjorvik. Maybe then I'd be able to cope with this place. He leads a life of unimaginable solitude. His main cabin is on Vida Fjord, but he's built four smaller ones a few days' walk away with scores of fox traps and self-shooting bear traps in between. He baits his fox traps with seabird heads, his bear traps with seal blubber, and checks them every fortnight. He wouldn't have had time to visit me if it hadn't been for the storm. It brought the deep snow, and foxes avoid that, as they fear becoming trapped in drifts and eaten by bears. He says that overhunting has made the catch worse than it used to be. Last winter, he only caught 12 foxes and 2 bears, although he got a decent price for the furs, and a chemist in Tromsø gave him 24 kroner for the bears' gallbladders, which are a cure for rheumatism. I find it odd that he can speak of those awe-inspiring bears and beautiful little foxes as if they were no more than animated furs, and yet he tamed an orphan cub as a husref, a house fox, and grieved when it sickened and died. I suppose he's too poor to be sentimental about animals. That's a privilege only the middle classes can afford. I suspect he deplores my lavishing butterscotch on Isak, although he's too polite to show it. And certainly he disapproves of the dogs running wild. To placate him, I've reverted to staking them by day and shutting them up at night, which they hate. I wish I knew why he always hunts alone, but he hasn't said and I won't ask. Once, though, he let slip that when he was young, he wasn't God's best disciple. And from other things, I gather that there are aspects of his past which he regrets. The sky is clear again, and the moon is back, although I'm alarmed to see how much it's waned. It changes all the time. Sometimes it's pale gold, sometimes blue-white, sometimes it's in a greyish halo, edged faintly with red. But in fact, it's not any of those colours. It's some moon colour I can't describe. Or perhaps it's no colour at all, perhaps the light isn't strong enough to allow my eyes to see in colour, so that what I'm seeing is the world in black and white, as Isak sees it. But why do I even try to describe the colours? Is it the human compulsion to name things, to assert control? Perhaps the same compulsion drives our meteorology, all that observing, measuring, recording, trying to render bearable this vast, silent land. And is that too why I've been writing this journal? To set down everything clearly, make sense of it. If it can be described, it can be understood. If it can be understood, it need not be feared. I say to set down everything, but of course I've been selective. And having flicked through these pages, I'm surprised at what I've chosen to put in. Why did I begin with that corpse being pulled from the Thames? And why mention that black-faced polar bear guarding its kill? Oh, it's wrong to say that I'm surprised at my selection. I'm alarmed. I don't like the pattern I'm making. And again, why write at all? Am I trying to make sense of what I've experienced, or am I trying to push it into the past to stop it bleeding into the present? If I was a different kind of man, I might be doing this to leave a record behind as a warning to others in case something happens to me. But I'm not unselfish enough for that. I don't care what happens after I'm dead. Although I do note the contradiction. On the one hand, I don't believe that anything of myself will survive death, while on the other, I know that Gruhuken is haunted. So, if it isn't that, then what? Am I trying to perform some kind of exorcism? Can you do that by writing things down? After the war, Father suffered the most dreadful nightmares. In fact, we all suffered, as his screams used to wake the whole house. One night, matters came to a head, almost literally. While sleepwalking, Father grabbed his service revolver from under his pillow and shot a German officer, who, he told us afterwards, he distinctly saw standing at the foot of the bed. The bullet passed clean through the bedroom wall and 6 inches over my head as I lay asleep in the next room. The following day, Mother took the gun and disposed of it. No idea how. Made Father see a nerve doctor. The doctor told him to write an account of his experiences in the trenches, to exorcise his demons. Of course he didn't, and the nightmares didn't last. He was already ill with the TB which killed him 2 months later. But is that, I wonder, what I'm trying to do now, exorcise my demons? Again, there's an inconsistency. I want to exorcise the haunting by writing about it, but I don't want to mention it out loud, for fear of invoking it. And how can I exercise it, when I don't know what it is? Later. That was a digression, but it did help clarify my thoughts. I know that Gruhuken is haunted, I know this. Some angry spirit walks this place. It is not an echo, it has intent, it wishes me ill. And I don't know how to appease it, or exercise it, because I don't know who, what, it is, or what it wants. Jovic knows something, I'm sure of it. I have to make him tell me, and I can't put it off any longer. Soon he'll leave. He's been away nearly a week. He has to check his traps. I've thought about going with him. But we couldn't take the dogs. They'd scare away the foxes and ruin his livelihood, and I can't leave them, I can't shoot them. I can't let the expedition fail. Same old arguments. Besides, it's only a matter of days before Gus and Algy get back. I can't put it off any longer. I have to talk to Bjorvik. He has to tell me what he knows. Chapter 14. 16th of November. Bjorvik is leaving tomorrow. He asked me to go with him. It was after supper. We were on our second mugs of coffee.
Mr. Jack, when I go, you come too, yeah? You bring the dogs. You stay with me.
It touched me deeply that he offered to take the dogs as well, but I also found it alarming. What danger does he think I'm in that he'd risk his livelihood to help me? For one crazy moment, I nearly said yes. But I can't do that to him. And I can't break faith with Algy and Gus. All right, to hell with Algy. I can't break faith with Gus. Jack, you're amazing. Expedition scuppered without you. That's what it comes down to. I keep picturing what it'll be like when he gets back. His blue eyes shining with gratitude and admiration. You did it, Jack. I didn't think anyone could, but you pulled it off. That's ridiculous, I know, and writing it makes me cringe, but that doesn't stop me playing it over and over in my head. Which is why when Bjorvik asked me to go with him, I said no. As I was trying to explain my reasons, it suddenly occurred to me that this was the third time I've refused an offer to leave Gruhuken. First Ericsson, then Gus, now Bjorvik. There's a horrible symmetry to that. In fairy tales, don't things always come in threes? And in the Bible? 3 times before the cock crows. It's as if I've been fated to be here on my own since the beginning. After I'd finished, Bjorvik said simply,
But, Mr. Jack, your friends, how long till they come?
Well, not long. They're setting out soon. They'll be here in 3 days at the most. They're wiring me tomorrow morning to finalize things. He didn't reply. I fetched the coffee pot and refilled our mugs. I spilt some on the table. I sat down and met his eyes. I said, Gruhuken is haunted. His gaze never left my face.
You're
isn't talking about things supposed to make them better? Well, it didn't. I felt as if I'd opened the window and let something in. Tell me, I said. Tell me what haunts this place. He took a pull at his coffee and set down his mug.
It's not good to talk of this.
But we must.
Mr. Yuck, there are things in the world we don't understand. It's best to leave it like this. Mr. Bjørvik, please. I have to know.
He was silent for a long time, staring into the stove's red heart.
Nobody knew his name, he said. A trapper. Men called him bad names. He never seemed to hear.
I stared at him.
You knew him?
Nobody knew him. Once, when I was young, I saw him. In Longyearbyen, 26, 27 year ago.
He grimaced.
When he was alive.
I swallowed. So, this was 1910 or thereabouts, before the war.
Yeah, it all happened before the war.
What he told me then came out in fits and starts, with long silences in between. He hated telling me, but I was relentless. Nobody knew where the trapper had come from, the wilds of North Norway. Somewhere poor. He worked his way to Spitsbergen on a whaling ship. He was ugly, and he had that abject manner which brings out the worst in people, particularly men. They gave him the filthiest, most degrading tasks. That was all it took, nothing more than an abject manner and ill-favoured looks. Bjørvik called him something in Norwegian, I think it means God-forgotten, one of life's rejects. At Longyearbyen he tried to get a place in the mines, but he wasn't strong enough, so they wouldn't take him. He tried selling fossils to tourists, but his appearance affronted them. Somehow he got work on a sealer and found his way to an isolated bay in the north. There he built a driftwood hut and took to fur trapping. For a few years he lived there on his own. Every summer he would turn up in Longyearbyen to sell his skins and pick up supplies. He couldn't read, and he'd never handled money, so people cheated him. After a few days he was gone again, back to the one place where no one set the dogs on him and called him names. Ruhuken. A mining syndicate took it from him. In this whole vast wilderness they had to have this one lonely bay. They'd found coal here. They staked their claim and threw him out.
I don't understand, I said. We found their claim sign.
The Edinburgh Prospecting Company, something like that.
But it was dated 1905.
Wasn't that before he got here?
Yeah, for sure. But, Mr. Yak, those signs, they say what they want.
You mean they backdated their claim? Wasn't that illegal? He snorted.
This was no man's land, no law. They do what they like.
So although he was here first, he was one. They were many. They threw him out.
And then?
He chewed his moustache.
He came back. They say they sent him on his way. They say they never saw him again.
They say, you mean it wasn't like that? His gaze slid to the fire.
I don't know. After that, nobody saw him. Alive.
But you know something, don't you? He shifted uncomfortably.
When miners have our money, Mr. Yak, they drink. When they drink, they talk. In those days, I drink, too. One night I am in the bar in Longyear.
He broke off. And they were there, the miners from Gruhuken.
One only.
By then the others were dead. And this miner, he told you what happened?
No.
But he talked and you overheard. He glared at me.
He was drinking himself to death.
He made no sense.
But you guessed.
What did they do to him?
The trapper of Gruhooken.
Suddenly he sprang to his feet, overturning his chair.
As God is my witness, he bellowed, I don't know.
A shocked silence. Slowly, Bjørvik righted his chair and sat down and scowled at the floor. I got up and walked to the window, then returned to my seat.
I'm sorry, but even if you don't know, I think you guessed something.
Tell me what you think happened.
He rubbed a hand over his face.
I think, when he came back, they were angry. I think at first they want just to beat him. Then it turned into something else.
He swallowed.
Men like that, when they know they won't be found out, they will do anything.
Glancing down, I saw that my hands were clenched. I thought of the blotchy stains on the bear post. I felt sick. After that, there wasn't much to tell. The mine limped on for another year, but it was dogged by misfortune. A cable severed a man's leg and he bled to death. A boat overturned, drowning two men within sight of the shore. Finally, a rockslide destroyed the cabins, and the surviving miners left. The following year, the prospecting company decided that the deposit wasn't rich enough after all, and abandoned the mine. Gruhooken stood deserted. It swiftly gained a bad reputation. People who camped here met with accidents, fire, drowning. A Swedish trapper shot his companion and then himself. The note on the body said he'd done it to escape the Gengonga, the one who walks again. There Bjørvik's account ended. But I know the rest of the story. For over two decades, Gruhooken remained deserted. Then, in 1935, topographers from Oxford University surveyed this stretch of coast and mentioned this bay as a likely site for future expeditions. Shortly afterwards, Gus Balfour read their report and put Gruhooken at the top of his list. The lamp had burned out. I refilled it and replaced it on the table. The smell of paraffin made me sick. Bjørvik sat with his hands on his knees, staring at the floor. I'd intended to tell him what I've experienced here, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. And he didn't want to know. I asked if he'd ever been to Gruhooken before now, and he said no. He's never hunted within 10 miles of the bay. I asked if he'd experienced anything untoward while he's been here. He said his dreams have been bad.
Only his dreams?
I envy him that. Again I went to the window. Couldn't see the moon. A wind was blowing from the east, sending fingers of snow across the shore. I turned back to Bjørvik.
What does it want?
He spread his hands. I understood. It wants Gruhooken, and I am in the way. 17th of November. I should have gone with him. But I was so sure that Gus and Algy would be back in a day or so, convinced that I could hold out until then. My hands are sweating. My fingers keep slipping on the pen. Why didn't I go with him? He left nearly 3 hours ago, just after breakfast. Although the moon is in its last quarter, the northern lights were bright, and he said he'd have plenty of light for skiing. He didn't repeat his offer to take me in, and I knew that since we'd spoken of the haunting, he couldn't wait to leave. I was right about that. Talking has brought it closer. I wanted him to give me some wise advice, or a talisman for repelling ghosts, as garlic is supposed to repel vampires. Even a Bible would have been a comfort. I don't believe in God, but I would have regarded it as a superior kind of amulet.
I told him this. Not about the amulet, but about the Bible. I tried to make a joke of it, but he shook his head. A Bible wouldn't help. I gave him a parting gift. As much bacon as he can carry, a packet of our best Virginia tobacco, and the 4 Edgar Wallaces he hasn't yet read. He was pleased. So at least I got that right. The last thing he said before he left was to be sure and keep the dogs close. First, I didn't feel too bad about being on my own again. Then an hour later, I spoke to Algy. I'd expected it to be Gus. I'd been looking forward to it. But it turns out that Gus has had some kind of setback. Algy swears he's not in danger, and I don't think he'd lie about that, but it means they can't set out yet. Sorry, Jack, a week till we can leave. Sorry. Stop. I was in shock. I couldn't take it in. Numbly, I sent back an acknowledgement. That's okay. Stop. Tell Gus get better soon. Stop. Okay. How is it okay? A week till they leave means maybe 9 days before they get here. That's nearly December. How can I hope that the coast will be clear of ice? I could be stuck here till spring. I'll never make it. When I got the transmission, I thought about going after Bjorvik. To hell with everything, just strap on your skis and get out of here. But by then he'd had 2 hours' start on me. And I don't know where his camp is. It isn't on the map. All I know is that it's somewhere on the far side of Vida Fjord, which is vast. I even thought of tracking him. But the wind has obliterated his trail. My wristwatch has stopped. But according to Gus's alarm clock, it's 11 in the morning. Another hour till I have to go outside and do the readings. Yes, we're back to that again, back to bolstering your courage with whiskey and cigarettes, back to bribing the dogs with sweets to keep them with you, back to watching the sky for the least trace of cloud. I keep wondering what they did to him, the trapper of Gruhugen. I think of that miner I saw at Longyearbyen. Men like that, when they know they won't be found out, they will do anything. I remember the malevolence of that figure in front of the cabin. The endless, black, inhuman rage. How can I hold out for another week? Later, I had a massive drink and a stiff talk with myself, and I feel a little steadier. What you've got to remember, Jack, is that it can't do anything to you. That's what I keep coming back to. That's why I still cling to the hope that I can hang on here until the others arrive. 'Cause what haunts this place is merely spirit. It is not matter. Not as I am matter. Not as this pen and notebook and table are matter. It can't hurt me. All it can do is frighten. Chapter 15. 18th of November. I knew things would change, but I didn't expect it to happen so quickly, and I never thought it would involve the dogs. While Bjørvik was here, I couldn't really imagine what it would be like when he left. A day later, and it's as if his visit never took place. The moon has waned. It's just a slit in the sky. The dark is back. Once I thought fear of the dark was the oldest fear of all. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's not the dark that people fear, but what comes in the dark, what exists in it. I'm prevaricating. The dogs. Yesterday, after Bjørvik left, I made a titanic effort to absorb the shock about Gus and Algy. I mustered my courage and did my work. I prepared food and forced it down. As I went about my duties, I experienced nothing untoward, no presence, no dread. only a shrinking inside me, the apprehension of what might come. By 6:30 I'd fed the dogs and was facing my first evening alone. I wasn't hungry, and although I was tired, I knew I wouldn't sleep, so I did what I've never done before and won't do again. I knocked myself out with morphine. I slept for 12 hours and woke 10 minutes before the 7 a.m. readings and made it by a whisker. I was on the bicycle generator, about to start transmitting, when I remembered I hadn't let out the dogs, or rather they reminded me with indignant complaints from the doghouse. As I was already late for Bear Island, I shouted to them to wait and set to work.